Welcome to Reading by Candlelight at Molly's Cottage, where we proudly celebrate and promote new Australian writers and their stories. I'm your host, Fiona Taylor. Each episode I chat to an author whose book features in Molly's gorgeous monthly book boxes, along with a selection of handmade items that complement the book setting. Reading by Candlelight would like to acknowledge the deep history and culture of Nipaluna, so I pay my respect to the original owners, the Muin and Aa people. I also pay my respects to all First Nations storytellers and their elders. So light a candle, settle back, and let's meet this month's Reading by Candlelight book box author. Welcome, Karina May, to Reading by Candlelight at Molly's Cottage. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you for having me, Fiona. It's such a great initiative. So I was just overjoyed to be asked to be in the box and on the podcast.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about your delicious rom-com, and I do mean delicious, Duck à l'Orange for Breakfast. And what a great cover. You must have been so happy with that.
I was. You do hear cover nightmares, and I just didn't have that at all, which is amazing. I am currently trying to work out how to get that blown up as a bit of artwork and frame, just so that I always have it. I always have plenty of copies here, but I think it's something different to have it framed, you know, in the office.
That's a wonderful idea. I love that. I think Karen Main's husband did that for her with the Lenny cover, and it looked fabulous. So I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, there's also artists that actually do like painting and recreations that I've had a look at, maybe commissioning something where they put them in tablescape. So the cover isn't the feature, but it's like a little book that's part of, which would fit perfectly with this book if it's part of a tablescape. And yeah, you have your like lush food and wine as part of it.
What a fabulous idea. I love that. Yes, please do it and share it everywhere. Now, a bit of background to start. Karina's a former magazine journalist turned digital marketer, an avid reader, and loves to write delectable love stories with a twist. She's also the co-host of That Rom-Com Pod with fellow author Claire Fletcher, where they talk about the highs and lows of classic and contemporary romantic comedies. Duck à l'Orange for Breakfast is published by Pan Macmillan Australia and is the Reading by Candlelight book box selection for November. Now, Karina, are you able to give listeners a spoiler-free, hard I know, elevator pitch for your book?
I think so. It's been a while since I've done it. But a duck à l'orange for breakfast, and my French has improved since saying the title numerous times. I don't speak French, surprisingly. I don't know how I came up with this book. But it follows Maxine Mayberry, who we meet at the hardest time in her life. She's just broken up with her long-term partner and being diagnosed with a pretty serious medical issue around the brain. And she moves in with her bestie, Alice. And as a distraction while she's whiling away the weeks leading up to her surgery, she joins Tinder and matches with pen pal Scott, and they start to cook through the recipe book of, Tinder pen pal Johnny. Oh, my God, the names. And she starts to cook through the recipe book of her ex-boyfriend's family, the Laurent family. So Scott Laurent is her ex-boyfriend. So it's kind of like a deranged Julia and Julia exercise, and it's called The Fork Him Project. And the story travels from Sydney to Paris, because I don't think that we can have French cooking without a trip to Paris. So it's a lively love story that kind of covers the globe and, yeah, has a whole lot of fun in the meantime.
I especially loved the idea of the Fork Him Project to help Max get her mind off her upcoming surgery and her breakup. It was such an unusual way to introduce Johnny's character, but it helped make the interactions between them seem fresh and current, especially as they met through Tinder.
Yeah, I think like that's the reality of a lot of modern dating in this age. So I guess I wanted to showcase that, something that I have done and lots of my friends have done. And the Fork Him Project came to me because I was looking for something that was really cute that they could do together. Initially, I was thinking craft because I'm actually not a huge foodie. I'm not a big cook, which we'll probably get to in terms of how I was able to come up with the recipes. But yeah, the Fork Him Project just kind of came to me I'd had a flatmate like a decade ago, and when she moved in with me, we had the recipe book randomly of her sister's ex-boyfriend in her packing boxes. We don't know how it got there, but when we unpacked it, we just had a bit of a giggle just thinking that we had these sacred family recipes that this family had no idea about. And we cooked a couple of the recipes until her sister found out that we had found this book and done that, and it hadn't been a great breakup. So she didn't find it as amusing as we did, but I think I always thought that that was, you know, you store these things, right? And you don't know when they're going to come out. So when I was looking for the perfect project for Johnny and Max to embark on, the Fork In project from, a decade ago, that idea kind of came to me. So it all slot into place.
That's wonderful. And can you explain why telling this particular story was important to you?
Yeah, sure. So I think the very beginning of the idea came, I wouldn't describe Duckel Orange as cichlid, but there's certainly a medical component, which is closely mirrors my own personal experience. So I was diagnosed with a benign brain tumor and underwent surgeries in 2019 and 2020. So not unlike Max, there are differences between kind of the medical conditions. But I think I was writing, obviously I've got a background in magazines. So I was writing nonfiction, and I had started dabbling in creative writing. I'd done a couple of courses, but I think it was going through the diagnosis and facing those surgeries that really helped clarify my purpose and my want to write, that cliche thing of everything being sharpened in your priorities when you're undergoing something that, you know, is potentially life-threatening or just really shakes up your world as you know it. So that was the initial idea. It came to me. But I think that the book as it stands now could probably work without that. People have said that, you know, it, even though it reads like, you know, she's experiencing this huge medical diagnosis, it's not a heavy book. So, but that definitely was what I wanted to, or what I started with, that fact that, you know, are you doing the thing that you want to do with your life? And I wasn't. So I pivoted into, you know, writing more and obviously got the book deal. So in that way, it closely mirrors kind of my own personal experience. But that's where the similarities end. I didn't have a Johnny.
I think that it's very inspirational, your story, Karina. And I think that it does go to show that sometimes we need something big to happen to in our lives, not something as horrible as what happened to you, but to make us realize that maybe we should be doing what we really want to be doing.
Yeah.
And just push a few other things aside. And so I'm so glad that you have had a full recovery from your ordeal.
Thank you. Yeah. So what it did was, I mean, as I said, I was already writing, but I just made more space for it. So I was turning 40 around the same year. And I branded up the year as the year of creativity. So I was managed, and that this is also like the means and privilege to be able to step down or scale down some of my paid work and step up the writing. And I found that when I put focus in that area, it paid off with the book deal, basically. So I am very woo-woo these days. I think just after facing that and then seeing when I put my mind to something and I had that realization. I wasn't half-assing it anymore. I was like, now I know for sure. This is what I was thinking about when I was laying in bed. This is what I want to do. And yeah, it paid off.
That's wonderful and such an inspirational story. And speaking of woo-woo, I love all the little references to ducks all the way through. It's absolutely gorgeous. And just how it reminds Max all the time of who she really cares for. It's fabulous.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You mean, if you follow me on social media, you would have seen how much fun I've had with duck content, to the point where I'm a bit sad to kind of, you know, move on to the next phase of my career and potentially leave ducks behind, although I've been given so many ducks from readers and lovely, lovely people in my life. So yeah, there's definitely ducks all around my apartment and all around my office.
That's gorgeous. Did it take you a long time to write it once you decided to start?
So I started, I had the first kind of seed of the idea when I was laying in ICU after the first surgery. So that was 2019. But when I say idea, you know, I was kind of starting to think about like what it was that I had to say about this whole ordeal. By the time I went into the second surgery in 2020, the plot had kind of started to form in my mind. So I joked that I went back for the second surgery for field research. So I was really paying attention to the sights and the sounds of ICU and how I was feeling. Directly after that surgery, obviously I had a lot of recovery time. I was hopped up on all these drugs. I thought that would be a great time to start writing. It wasn't for lots of reasons, just because it was still so fresh and I needed to give myself recovery. So I probably wrote about 20,000 words directly in 2020. But then I put it aside and picked it back up in 2021. And then I think it probably took me about 8 months, to write it from end to end, but there had been a lot of thought process that had gone into it and the beginnings of things, which I'm sure I cherry picked some of those words because that was the raw emotion. So it was kind of the foundational stuff that I needed, I think, to give the book its heart.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I think that, yeah, it's interesting that how much time goes into the preparation before you begin to write. And I think that you've explained that really well. But what I'm really interested in is what kind of research did you need to do apart from, you know, going back and having the second operation? Because are you moonlighting as a professional chef now?
So this is what happened. So I came up with the Forkin project and then I put myself in the seat of a reader, which is not hard to do, or the lounge of the reader. I'm a huge reader and I thought I'd be so disappointed if I read a book about food and with this level of detail and the recipes weren't provided at the end. So straight away I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this considering I'm not a huge cook? I'm definitely, yeah, more of a Max type, keep sweaters in the oven, Carrie Bradshaw type of character. So it ended up being one of those serendipitous type of kismet things, which kind of happened a lot with this book, where I was speaking to a friend and her brother had recently moved to Geneva, and so very close to France, and had taken up cooking and was going to the market every weekend and buying fresh produce. And she kind of, we had a conversation and she said to me, hey, my brother started cooking, like he might be happy to help you with these dishes. So we called him and he answered literally with a jar of foie gras in his hand and said, like, I've just made this. So that was the way that I was able to get the recipes happening. It started before I got my publishing deal. So he has a family. So he was cooking kind of leisurely on the weekends, one dish a week. And we had come up with a rough menu based off the Forkin project, but occasionally he'd say to me, you know, there's artichokes at the market, they're so great, can we have an artichoke dish? And so we'd swap and change. And then when I had my publishing deal, obviously it became less of a creative fun project and more of a, we've got deadlines. Chris Alagna's his name, and so he's credited in the book. So he definitely helped color a lot of the language that I needed. As I said, I'm a huge consumer and I enjoy food, but I'm not the best cook. So a lot of the descriptions came directly from him describing the produce that he saw that week in the market. There's a line, yeah, about artichokes the size of soccer balls, and that came directly from his mouth, as did most of it.
That's wonderful, because I loved all the references to food in the book. And especially I loved the recipes at the end of the book. I was so excited when I got to the end and I read the acknowledgement. And I also love the fact that all the recipes have little bits
between
Johnny and Max. And so you kind of get a little insight into their story. And I love that. And so if you don't cook, have you cooked any of the recipes yourself?
I feel like such a fraud. I had planned in the lead up before launch, before I knew what it was like to launch a book, I was going to, in the 14 days in the lead up, do a dish a day, you know, for excitement. And that did not happen because I didn't realize, you know, how involved some of these recipes were. But I've had, I think, basically every dish has been cooked now by a reader, which is amazing. So A lot of readers post the dishes and I send them straight to Chris. He's still in Geneva. So we've got like a little WhatsApp group happening. And each time he's just amazed that someone has used his recipe. And by all accounts, they're amazing. The only one that I've cooked I don't want to give it away, but the one that Chris did not cook. So a recipe that's not so French. That's the only one that I've done. But that's why I feel like a fraud, because I haven't even cooked the recipes in my own book.
It's not a fraud. There's nothing that says that because you write something comes out of your imagination that you have to have done it yourself first. But I'm definitely going to cook some of them, and I'm going to pop up the results on the Reading by Candlelight socials because I love to cook. And I looked at them and I thought, I can do
something. I've heard the duck is really, really good, and the creme brulee, which probably has the most offensive name in the book, is really good as well. Yeah, they're the two that I've heard like rave things about.
I'm not going to call them by their names.
No, it's funny because when the book released, there was a lot of bookstores that kindly had the book in the window. There was a window competition and a lot of them had the menus stuck up and there was dishes missing for reasons when people read the book. It's a bit cheeky, yeah.
I'll understand. Now, on your website, I love your acknowledgement that travel is compulsory to maximize holiday tax write-offs. So what I want to know is, did you get to travel to France for this book, or had you already been?
Yeah, France came about in a way. Initially, this book, she travels to Montreal in Canada because I had spent more time in Montreal. So I wrote this book while we were in and out of COVID lockdowns. So unfortunately, I didn't get to travel to France. But when I decided to switch it from Montreal to Paris, just because I thought we have to go to Paris, like this is French, the heart of French cooking. Luckily, I had been in Berlin the end of 2019 for a couple of months just before my first surgery as a like last hurrah in case, you know, anything happened. And I had not planned on going to Paris, but I found out a good friend was there. And so I got the 8-hour train there because the flights were so expensive, and spent like a 24-hour whirlwind day with her, which is why probably the description, I think when you travel anyway, I mean, you're more observational, but things are rose-colored glasses. You're stepping out of your own world and you're stepping into like a fantasy world, especially when you're in a place for such a short period of time. So that was the place my brain went back to anyway, when, you know, it was just the four walls of my living room, like was the case for most people, that I was able to tap into that 24-hour whirlwind time I had with my friend. So that was 2019. I had been there previously for longer periods of time, but I think I was trying to really encapsulate that snapshot of that feeling, which is why there's not granular details about, you know, tourist attractions and things in Paris. That's not what it was about. I was trying to capture that wanderlust feeling, where I feel the most inspired as well as a writer.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you've explained why you felt that they had to go to France, and I absolutely agree, because it's part of the cooking and it's part of the adventure, and it's also a wonderful juxtaposition between what she's experiencing at home and what she finds out about herself there. And people just have to read the book to find that out.
Yeah, one reader in their review, it's so funny when you read reviews and you see things for the first time, that someone felt that it went from black and white to colour when it stepped into France. Oh. And I really like that kind of Wizard of Oz kind of feeling. That wasn't intentional, but I can definitely see like how that feeling came about.
Such a great description.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, as I've mentioned, you have your own podcast, That Rom-Com Pod, with fellow author Claire Fletcher. And it's so good. I think everyone should start listening to it. I highly recommend it. It gives you such great, good vibes and feels, and it's so much fun. And it's obvious that you and Claire have a wonderful friendship because it comes through in the episodes. And what is it about rom-coms that you love so much?
Thank you. And thanks, Fiona. And I've been loving your podcast as well, this one, and also The Workout. I think so. Claire and I initially connected maybe a year or so ago, and it was over the love of rom-coms. We both write them, but we say first and foremost, we're consumers of them. The feeling of the podcast is exactly what we were trying to, what I get from rom-coms, which is that warm and fuzzy feeling. And I think we have seen a trending up of rom-com, and also just the shamelessness of it and loving them, because it's a bit of an antidote to the times at the moment. You know, there's a lot happening globally, nationally, COVID and now. So I think we want to lean in to feeling good. Like, I write for joy and to feel good. And it's what my comfort watches are. And I think as well with book talk, there's a younger generation who are kind of rediscovering those noughties rom-coms for the first time. A lot of this stuff is ripe for rediscovering, and it makes us excited again to talk about things that perhaps we haven't watched or read for a decade, and revisiting those. So it's such a joyful thing for us to do. It's just, you know, a creative project and speaks directly to our interests.
I know that we can't have a favorite child, but which character did you enjoy writing the most?
I think maybe Max's best friend, Alice. She's, you know, in rom-coms, there's typically that quirky side character, best friend. And I think Alice is just that. She is also a bit of a voice of reason for Max. So I loved her for that, as well as providing some light. So she knows when to, you know, be light and when to, really push Max, hold up a bit of a mirror to Max as to how she's behaving. But also I had a lot of fun giving her own subplot and love story as well, which I didn't want her. I wanted her to be a fully fleshed character. So I had lots of fun with her. And then she also gets rewarded for being such an amazing part of the story.
No, she was wonderful. And I mean, I think that people are going to love Johnny. Okay. But my favorite was probably Suzette in Trunk.
Oh, yes. I've heard that a lot. And it's funny because she's also a voice of reason. But the audiobook, which was voiced by Rose Flanagan, she did such an amazing job. I was able to actually listen to that, which I hear is quite rare for authors to be able to listen back to their work. But there was something about someone else voicing it that made me feel separate from the work. And she does an amazing Suzette. She kind of does, that Canadian accent, but not too much. And the way she voiced her was exactly how I pictured writing her. So that was such a real joy to listen to that and hear the character of Suzette, and her chickens.
I felt that Suzette felt wonderfully alive on the page, and I wish I had someone like her to set me up in a library and encourage me to write.
You know how many, so many messages about people going, can I also stay at Suzette's house? Like, don't we all want to go and stay at Suzette's house? That kind of came about because whenever I do my writing retreats, like my solo ones, you know, I think it's great for writers to go away with other writers and write. Occasionally, typically in January, when I'm starting something new, I'll take myself away for 3 or 4 days, and I've learnt staying completely alone is not good for me. So I do look for renting a room in someone's house. And I've stayed with some amazing, typically women characters. So I kind of mesh a few of those people that I've stayed with in Airbnbs into the one character. They exist out there.
That's fabulous. I also love the banter between Max and Johnny. It was so well written, and actually it was so funny. You must be very funny.
I think it's more that I've just unfortunately had a lot of experience on those dating apps. So I say as a joke that I just made Johnny like what I would like to receive back, you know, but don't always. But, yeah, I think given the last few years, laughing is a great way to get through things. So I certainly leant into that. That's why I wanted to make it clear that Duck L'Orange, although it deals with heavier issues, it does it quite lightly, and it was maybe something that I hadn't really read or seen, the lightness to it while still taking it seriously, but it's how I cope with most things. It's my default. So.
I found myself smiling whenever they sent messages to one another, and their flirting is so adorable.
Oh, thanks.
Now, if Duck was to be picked up for the screen, who could you imagine playing Max and Johnny? This is one of my favorite questions. I love doing this.
I know. And this is so hard as well. I've thought about this for a while. For Max, I've always say Megan Fahey. I actually don't even know that's how you pronounce her surname. So she was in The Bold Type and most recently on White Lotus. There's something, because I think of Max as quite, she's a little bit earnest as well. Although, you know, she definitely has, you know, a bit of a quick wit about her. And then this dates me, and he's also not Greek, so I'm still auditioning for the Greek hero that is Johnny. But while I was writing it in my head, I had Joshua Jackson from Dawson's Creek, but he's about a decade too old, and he's also not Greek, so definitely still open for casting there.
I loved Pacey Witters.
I love him so much. Like, Dawson's Creek is my comfort show. Like, I'll watch that over and over. And I think I do probably picture Joshua Jackson too much when I'm writing my heroes. I need to get like a new fixation, someone a little bit, I guess more current.
Well, for Johnny, here you could have a thought and a look at Alex Andreas.
Oh, okay.
Brilliant in The Tourist last year, and he was born in Melbourne to Greek parents.
Oh my gosh, okay.
I think he'd be perfect.
This is amazing, because I've had a lot of people send me like Pinterest models, like this is who they picture, but they're not actors, so I didn't know who.
Oh, yet. I will send you a picture of him.
Please.
Very nice.
I'll send it straight to Hollywood.
And for Max, I was wondering maybe Bibi Bettencourt. She was in The Dry, and she has this amazing ability of creating quiet strength from fragility. And she's immediately who came to my mind when I was reading it.
Gosh, amazing. You may have just cast for me. Please send so I can put it in my proposal to Hollywood. Don't worry, I've already sourced the actors.
Would that be wonderful? If it was so that easy.
I know, like everything in this life.
Now, for all our writers listening, are you a plotter or a pantser?
This is the most annoying answer, because I think I'm both. I'm the plantser, a hybrid. Yeah, so.
An annoying answer. I think that's most writers.
Yeah, I definitely. This one I probably plotted more than what I normally do, just because the sections are not chronological. And so I did actually get out post-its and post it out like how I wanted the sections. And from submission to how it ended up being published, that didn't change. So I felt quite smug about that I had like done my plotting correctly. But typically I'm a bit odd in that I need to have a title before I start writing. So, and again, I'm quite smug in that none of my titles have changed yet. Like a lot of times the publisher will retitle. It's very common to retitle your book. So I'm 100% marked so far. And it's something about, I identify as a structured creative in my day job now. I'm a digital marketer, so that's quite analytical part of my brain. But the title helps me stay kind of contained within my creativity. So I love the title. And then one thing that I definitely will do is not stop writing for the day unless I know what I'm doing the next day. So that does typically mean plotting out a little bit in advance. And then I always have a rough idea. If you have a rough idea of what you want your story to say, normally the plot comes with that. So I will have a rough idea of things. That's not always written down though. Sometimes it's just in my head. Like right now I have two that I've both started, because that's always smart to do two projects at once. And a lot of the plotting's in my head still, and I know I have to write it down, and I just haven't done that yet, because I also get scared about taking away from the magic. A lot of what happened in Duck, those threads just come together in the subconscious, and I feel if I think about it too much, maybe the magic quality will disappear. So, But if I was writing something like crime, which I think you're doing now, aren't you, Fiona? I feel like I might have to plot because I honestly don't know how crime writers do that, and the slowly unpicking of the narrative, and all these red herrings. I think I would, yeah, I would lose it.
Yeah. What I loved about what you said is that I admire the fact that you didn't write the story chronologically. I like it when it goes back in time because you couldn't have had that at the front.
It
wouldn't have given it the impact that what you put at the start did.
Yeah, and I think that's where like writing courses do come into play. Obviously, I'm a writer by background of trade, but I think it's different to learn how to structure a novel. So I did the How to Write Your Novel in 6 Months course at Australian Writers' Centre here in Sydney twice. So not for Duck either, which is very common with most writers, you know, have other training novels and manuscripts. So I think understanding or learning about the elements of how to structure a novel for pace helped me structure that. And I definitely wouldn't have been able to do that, I think, without having had that guidance and training. I had initially started, when I started writing a novel, stringing some blog posts together. So just like Max, I used to write vignettes, just little short stories of funny things that have happened in my life, a lot of dating stories. And initially I had a whole collection of those and I thought if I strung them together, maybe I could make a book, which is not how you typically write a book. So I learned all about story structure from, attending a lot of courses, which has been so helpful.
Now, is that the advice you'd give to anybody writing to be published?
That for writing, I think. I mean, everyone says to just keep going, which is really difficult because that's all well and good, but finding the time and finding the motivation. So the advice I would be is also to surround yourself by like-minded people, which Fiona, I know you're so in the community, you're in it, you're going to events. And I think all of that helps with motivation because you're inspired by people around you that have done the thing that you want to do, or you're just chatting about ideas and hearing from other authors. And then I think in terms of the publishing aspect of it, not giving up. So to get this publishing deal, I followed up quite a few times to the point where the last time I followed up, I just thought, should I send this last email? And it was that last email that got the reply. I mean, not in a stalker way, like maybe cap it, but I think if you really want it, perseverance as well.
That's fabulous advice. I love that. Now, for all our readers out there, can you recommend a book by an Australian author that you've read recently and would recommend? And yes, you can have more than one.
Good. So I have to, of course, mention my podcast buddy, Claire Fletcher. So her latest release is Love Match, which is a follow-up in the same world to her first book, Five Bush Weddings, which is set in South Star. And it's perfectly timed, I think, for after the World Cup soccer, because it's based around a women's football team. So that is such a fun read and a lot of heart to that book as well. And then two books that will be coming out, I think in January, potentially February next year, that I've just finished. One is Natalie Murray's Love Just In. That's being published by Allen and Unwin, and she's a debut novelist. And it's kind of like an Australian Emily Henry, which I know a lot of people are huge Emily Henry fans. Set in Newcastle, so at a lovely Australian setting, and it kind of goes sweet to sexy, so you get a lot of banter, but then you get a lot of heat as well, which I love to read. And then the third one is Jodie McAllister. She is also an Australian author, and she writes the Marry Me Juliet series, which is loosely based, well, not loosely, but it's kind of based on a fictionalized bachelor. And her third book of the series, Not Here to Make Friends, is out in January. And I read all three in a row and binged them while I was recently away. And it was kind of like binging like the best reality TV show. So all in that rom-com vein, which I do read out of genre, but definitely that's where I find myself frequently picking books back up that just make me happy.
Yeah, we go back to our comfort food, don't we? Now, I'm very excited for your next book, Never Ever Forever, that will be published next month, won't it?
Yes. Yes. Very busy. Yeah.
The duck.
Yeah.
Please share with our listeners what Never Ever Forever is all about.
This will be one of the first times I've done this, so this shall be interesting. But Never Ever Forever is another wanderlusty rom-com, and it follows Rosie Royce, who is a city girl, like a serial planner who is done with dating, and she's just over all the F-boys in Sydney City. And so she moves to the country on one last hope of kind of finding that kind-hearted farmer that she sees on the television. But she moves to Mudgee, and along the course of the story, she ends up in Mumbai. So not a spoiler, but there's no kind-hearted farmers, but there is an egotistical radio co-host of hers. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun to write. It's kind of a second-chance romance and enemies to lovers combined. So now that Claire and I have been doing the podcast, I'm hugely into tropes, so it was fun to kind of identify the ones that are in this story. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun to write. It's a bit... yeah, it's still very contemporary, but it's a bit of Rosie's in her 20s, so she's a little bit of a younger character than Max. But, yeah, a lot of fun.
Fabulous. And that comes out, I believe, on the 28th of November.
Yes, so they technically call it December release. I've gotten used to all of this now, but it does come out November 28th, so just in time for Christmas, which will be a lot of fun.
Yes, it's a wonderful Christmas present, folks.
Yes, yes.
Now, on behalf of Molly's Cottage, I'd like to thank Karina for talking with me today on Reading by Candlelight. And Duck a L'Orange will be the November book box for Reading by Candlelight, available at Molly's Cottage as a one-off purchase or subscription. Now, this novel is as delightful as it is mouthwatering, and I can't wait to try my hand at some of the recipes. And it was such a pleasure talking with you, Karina.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Fiona.
You're welcome. And we wish you all the very best for your new book, Never Ever Forever. Perfect Christmas present. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for visiting Molly's Cottage, home of the Reading by Candlelight book box, the only book box subscription that supports emerging Australian authors and their stories. Head to Molly's website, mollyscottage.com.au, or follow her and Reading by Candlelight on socials.